This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Broadway icon John Cameron Mitchell channels the essence of his glam rock icon, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, for one night only at Arts Centre Melbourne this July. So put on some makeup, turn up the A-track and pull the wig down from the shelf. John Cameron Mitchell, July 10 at Arts Centre Melbourne. Book now. Joy sponsor.
Here's another Saturday Magazine podcast brought to you by Joy sponsor, Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Across Melbourne on Joy 94.9 and streaming online at joy.org.au, you're listening to Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12.
And you are listening to Saturday Magazine with Macca Tass, myself, and of course Dean Smith, Senator Dean Smith, all the way here from WA.
Via South Australia.
Via South Australia.
Regional South Australia at that.
Oh dear.
So while you were in South Australia, you actually did something about nuclear waste.
I did a Senate colleague a favour and stepped in for her. Actually, a Victorian senator, Senator Jane Hume, who does great work.
Now, we must get her on.
I think that would be wonderful to get her on. She's a great champion for Victoria, a very, very great champion for causes that are important to us and our listeners. But I was in South Australia to participate in what's called the Senate Economics Committee Inquiry into identifying a radioactive waste facility location somewhere in Australia and what's happened over the last few years.
Are they still working on that?
Still, exactly, Taz. This is the point. And
I worked on that from a Victorian perspective in the 1990s.
So you didn't get it right. So
no, nobody's got it right.
We're still dealing with that. Well, I travelled all the way to Kimber and Hawker and to Port Augusta, met with Indigenous communities, met with local farmers. Look, it's an important issue because...
And, of course, nobody wants it.
Oh, no. Well, interestingly, Taz, interesting, there were, you know, tale of two towns, if you like. I need to be careful what I say because we've not yet reported on our sort of findings and deliberations. But there was, in my mind, there was clearly some people who were very strongly against it. Mm. And at one of the other locations we went to, I was more satisfied that there was a community that were happy to have it because they could see some of the economic benefit and economic development. But, of course, what we're talking about is how we properly dispose of, you know, medical isotopes and those sorts of things. The radioactive waste that comes from... Modern medicine, modern science, currently housed at Lucas Heights in New South Wales. So that took me out of Western Australia on Wednesday and then into Melbourne late last night. So it's great to be here.
I have a view about South Australia.
One you're sharing?
It should be fenced off.
Well, actually, I know the perfect place.
I have a radical plan.
Yeah, go on. What was...
I have a radical plan, and we'll get to GST issues shortly, yep. I hope, Macca, but I have a radical plan that often I hear Northern Territorians talk about statehood. Now, of course, that would sort of, you know, significantly rearrange our constitutional arrangements, give the Northern Territorians 12 senators. I like the idea of having the state of South Australia and Northern Territory.
As one.
When you think about the sort of tremendous economic development opportunities that are happening across Darwin, gas, etc. You know, when you think about, you know...
Good idea.
It means you could just put a line through the middle of the country.
Yeah.
And Western Australia would finally be free.
That's right. Now, I know two places where we could store the nuclear waste. One is Barnaby Joyce has got some spare land. I think it's going to have a train track through the middle of it. That'd be a good place. The other is, what about in David Lionhorn's backyard? He's a bit of a waste. He wouldn't be alone.
Well, let's talk...
Not too sure where David lives, actually.
Let's talk about David and let's talk about his comments. So what's the general consensus in the room, in the studio this morning about his comments? Macca, let's start with you.
I didn't like bullies at school. I don't like people that are authentically sexist. I don't like... pompous,
authentically sexist.
Yeah,
like, what's that?
Well, that's actually his core belief, as opposed to something that he might say occasionally in a conversation that you often regret. But sometimes these things are in your mind and you can't always. So, what do I think? I think he's a turd. I think he's a blot on the landscape of democracy. And I think the things that he's said, not just in the last week, some of the things he said are some of the greatest arguments for there not to be representation in the Senate the way it is. You know.
Whoa.
A couple of, you know, what did he get, 3% of the vote?
Yeah, something like that. I have a view that we shouldn't actually mention his name too often, just in case any of our listeners decide to actively support him. Mind you, I'm not sure that listeners would support.
Look, I just think the way he has behaved and saying, you know, look, I deal with, you know, everyday Australians and they talk like this. Okay, I'm not going to argue with him. There is a portion of Australia that talks like this. It doesn't make it right, David. It doesn't make it right. He's doing it to get a greater profile ready for the next election. He got elected last time, pretty much by a fluke and some preference deals. He doesn't have wide support. He's doing this to get attention, pure and simple.
Dean, what's your view?
Look. The challenge for someone like me is that I get to work with Sarah Hanson-Young on issues, and I get to work with David Lyon-Helm on issues. One of the real, you know, stepping back before I give a view, one of the real challenges I think for, you know, parliamentarians is when they are in Parliament doing their job, is that often you'll see a parliamentarian with a number of different faces or masks. There's the mask that they wear in the chamber. You see it at question time, very aggressive, interruption, etc. There's the mask you might see them wear at a committee hearing. You know, they're polite, they're courteous. And then there's the media mask. You see them you know, performing in front of the cameras, you know, on Q&A and these sorts of things. So one of the big challenges is to find out which is the most accurate or authentic mask. And I certainly know for myself that I just prefer as best I can to wear the same mask the whole way through. I find that less emotionally exhausting for myself.
You're talking about being your authentic self.
Yeah, absolutely.
You are who you are, you present who
and
you
I think,
are.
And I think it's important that people get to see consistency, particularly in politics. I don't like bad language. I'm a bit of a prude like that. I mean, I know bad language, don't get me wrong, but and I've used it on occasion, but I do find it a bit, I'm a bit prudish like that. I don't like that sort of language. I think that we need to be, and remembering too, that people like myself, and indeed Janet Rice and others, have had to put up with a lot of shit. But my approach is you grin and bear it and you keep walking through. I think it's unfortunate. I mean, I can't understand why it has occupied so much media attention, but perhaps it's occupied the media attention because people do find it outrageous and unfortunate. I certainly know for myself, you know, we're all human, but when you carry the title senator or member of parliament or pastor or priest, we don't want to go there, but there's a heavy burden and responsibility that comes with that. I'll tell you one anecdote. School children come to the parliament and they have a special area above the chamber which is glassed off so the teachers can teach them about what's happening
in
the parliament.
They can comment on what's happening.
But they don't interfere with the happenings. The consistent feedback I've had over many years now is that what surprises the children, school children, who
is
come to
behavior.
Is the behaviour. They come to our national parliament, hopefully to be, you know, their ideas about democracy and democratic participation enhanced, enthused, and they walk away thinking, wow. And it's a struggle for the teachers because if children behave like that, they wouldn't be in the classroom.
No, that's right. But I think what most people don't realise about Parliament is that it's actually all about theatrics and performance. And a lot of it is really designed to, you know, create attention, emphasise points of view and exaggerate what's really going on for political gain at the end of the day.
And you see that most vividly at the 5 minutes to two on a parliamentary sitting day. The chamber comes alive and then it's lights and action at 2 o'clock and you can see it subside again at about 3 p.m.
And then there's never more than three people in parliament for the rest of the
day. After that, that's exactly right. That's
now, of course...
unless we're passing the same-sex marriage bill, of course, Ted.
Yeah, of course. now, the interesting thing about all of that is that the behaviour that's been called out is sexism. Mm. And we've had another former MP, Cheryl Cuno, for example, come forward and say, well, in the 20 years that she's been missing from Parliament, nothing's changed. Yep. Another one of your colleagues...
I think it's got worse.
Well, another one of your colleagues, in fact, Senator Hanson, came forward and said, well, you know, yes, it is sexist, but she did actually comment on Senator Hanson Young's behaviour and argued that, in fact, her behaviour wasn't always, you know, courteous and kind and tactful.
Look, I think I may as well just cut to the chase. I think it's unacceptable behaviour. This is not the time when... this is the time when Australians want to have their faith in parliamentarians restored, upheld. This is a distraction. It looks like parliamentarians are operating in a bubble. I think good behaviour begets good behaviour. Mm. Courtesy and respect is something that we expect across the Australian community, and we should absolutely expect it at every level from every senator in the parliament.
Now, Dean, I wanted to... we're probably, when Misha Ketchell from the conversation comes in, I'm sure we're going to talk about religious freedom, and Anna Brown from the Human Rights Law Centre. But I've actually got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
What is the one... I know you're a great believer in democracy.
Mm-hmm.
You also believe in a constitutional monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
What is the one thing...
That might be a fight that I end up losing, Macca, but I don't like to admit that. It's just between you and I.
You will lose that.
I'm
a fighter.
you're a believer in representational democracy.
Mm.
What is the one thing the royal family, or the two things the royal family can't do? Do you know?
Is it a question? Is it like a quiz question? Or?
Well, no. There's a prize. You get a bottle of plonk. Look, the question.
We know that they don't and can't and don't vote.
Correct.
And they can't and don't.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's two different things. So they can't vote, but they actually choose not to vote.
Mm.
Could they vote if they really?
Well,
want
I think
to?
The answer to that is that they couldn't vote.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Because that would undermine that that foundational principle that they're sort of above politics.
Yeah. And they can't be elected because of that. So. My question is, as a believer in representational democracy, that the people or the person who sits at the very top of that pole for Australia, let's put aside the Governor-General, the Queen is our head of state. She can't vote. She chooses not to vote. If she could vote, she wouldn't vote. But she can't also be elected. It's hereditary.
Mm.
So how is that democratic?
That's a really good question. I'm glad I'm on radio and not television with you. it's a very, very good question. This is how I sort of reconcile that, if you like. When we think of alternative systems, what we have to give up is the independence or lack of partisanship in the head of state function. So... I think that's a very high price to pay. The second point that weighs heavily on me is the argument that this is a system that has worked remarkably well for our country, So I want to be absolutely convinced by others that change is necessary and that the type of change that we're being asked to embrace doesn't invite into our head of state function a very significant sort of dose of partisanship, if you like. So those are things that weigh heavily on me. Actually, this is a really interesting question because Paul Ritchie, who wrote that wonderful book about why conservatives should support gay marriage last year, he has actually written a collection of essays. He's called it The Forgotten People Updated, sort of taking from the Menzies book. And I've written a chapter in there, what is it that liberals can agree on, irrespective of whether they are Republicans or constitutional monarchists? And what I've said in that book is that we must keep at the heart of our decision-making parliament and parliamentary sovereignty. And effectively what I'm saying is that the direct election model of a president or a head of state would invite a lot of that partisanship that we've been free of in our national politics at that level. So it's a good question because you're right. It's almost a disconnect, if you like. There's my faith in constitutionalism. There's my faith in democratic participation. There's my faith in parliamentary sovereignty. But then I want to crown that. Excuse the pun. I want to crown that with a constitutional monarch. On this, I'm absolutely not for budging. I do think that the system's worked remarkably well for us. The fact that Australians don't have to worry about how I don't see this issue as symbolism. I see this as about governance and process, and I know that other people do see it about symbolism. Mm. They do see it as
people often see it as being about identity as well. And it's about us being able to determine who our head of state is, as opposed to it being somebody that belongs not only to another country, but actually is just happens to be born in another family.
Mm. But yeah, I understand that. I hear that. That's not the thing.
You should
that fashions
support Prince Philip's of Greece.
But I don't support.
That's not the thing that fashions or governs my sort of consideration on this. Mm. I mean, I do, of course, and many Australians would have tremendously high regard for the Queen and the role that she's played. But I don't see this about the Queen. I see this as about a constitutional monarch and head of state.
If I can point out to you, there are three instances where the monarch or the monarch's representative have failed to be non-partisan. One was Sir Philip Game in New South Wales, who sacked Jack Lang, ostensibly because Lang refused to make interest payments to the bondholders in London.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But, a small matter of another organisation that was involved very strongly there called the New Guard.
And Jack Lang actually was a political mentor, if you like, to both Keating and Mr. Turnbull used to truck up College Street, I think it was. Yep.
And the other was, of course, Sir John Kerr.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is where we...
Which I think the weight of evidence that is publicly available does show that he broke conventions in terms of seeking advice outside his government, right? You won't convince me that he wasn't partisan. But, the example I'm going to give you, when Churchill was very ill in his second time as Prime Minister, and the Queen was involved in the discussion as to who the new leader of the Conservative Party would be.
A young Queen Macca, an inexperienced Queen, perhaps poorly advised.
But...
not Whoa. Without its faults. So what you're saying, if you're saying constitutional monarchy is faultless, I disagree with you because it clearly does have its faults, but the weight of evidence, I'd argue, is that it is a stable, reliable form of government. Now, we'll have to disagree on the Whitlam situation. You won't be surprised to hear that, because when it was put to popular vote, which was part of the decision, there was an overwhelming decision by the Australian people.
Don't forget, in the 1930s, there was also a plebiscite in Austria which had a popular vote, so we won't hang our hats
We don't like popular votes generally because we support parliamentary, but that popular vote was an election.
Exactly, and a popular vote on marriage equality, that served us.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.